Well, Genesis chapter 30. And did you read this chapter? Oh my. Where do you start? Well, did you hear about the rich man who had pity on two poor sisters? He married both women. Afterwards, he boasted, "That was mighty big of me. That was mighty big of me." Hey, nobody knew the perils of multiple wives more than Jacob. He married Leah, then he married Rachel, then he had children with Rachel's maid Bilhah, then later with Leah's maid Zilpah. What was this man thinking? He set himself up for double trouble. From the beginning, God's plan for marriage was one man and one woman in a lifelong relationship. But how quickly standards get compromised in a fallen world. Culture compromises and shortcut cuts get taken. Fallen humans act as if they know more than God. And society devolves in its quality of life. This happened in the days of the Hebrew patriarchs. Multiple wives and concubines and baby maids convoluted what God envisioned for healthy families. And Jacob's dysfunctional family was the quintessential example. And this is a warning to people today who want to redefine marriage and family. Folks are discarding the nuclear household to experiment with different configurations of family life these days. And yet modern families are nothing new. They have been tried and they have failed. If you doubt the wisdom of God's original design for family, just read Jacob's story. This man lived and his children were raised among four warring women. Genesis 30 begins. Now, when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." Oh boy. Jacob's once beloved Rachel desperately wants a baby, and she blames her lack of one on her husband Jacob. Now realize, in antiquity, barrenness was seen as a divine curse. Childless meant unloved by God. And I hope you never draw that unbiblical conclusion. For God never ties proof of his love to our circumstances. It's the cross. It's our embrace of Jesus. This is the proof of his love for us. But Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" So she said, "Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her, and she will bear a child on my knees that I also may have children by her." Surrogate motherhood was common in the ancient world. You remember this was how Abram and Sarah tried to solve their barrenness with their maid Hagar. That too got them into trouble. Well, then she gave her Bilhah, her maid, as wife, and Jacob went into her. And Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has judged my case, and he has also heard my voice and given me a son." Therefore, she called his name Dan, which means judge. In Rachel's mind, this son was God's vindication on her life. She concludes, "God has approved of me." Now, verse 7. And Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And then Rachel said, "With great wrestlings, I have wrestled with my sister, and indeed I have prevailed." See, this childbearing in this family had devolved into a competition between sisters. She called his name Naphtali, which means my wrestlings. Oh my. And now the baby battle really rages. When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, you remember in Genesis 29, Leah had birthed four sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah. But now to keep up with her sister, she takes Zilpah, her maid, and gives her to Jacob as wife. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And then Leah said, "A troop comes." So she called his name Gad, which means troop. Leah vows that her maid is now going to have an army of babies. We're going to one-up that Rachel. This is a real baby shootout now. And Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, I am happy, for the daughters will call me blessed. So she called his name Asher, which means happy. But trust me, Leah is the only person in this dysfunctional family who is happy at this time. Verse 14, the plot thickens. Now Reuben went in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field. Now this term mandrake, it literally means love apples. This was a plant with dark leaves. It often had blue and yellow blossoms. The ancients believed that these mandrakes enhanced sexual fertility. Now Reuben brought them to his mother Leah, trying to help her out. Then Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? And boy, can't you hear the jealousy? That comment is rife with jealousy. Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, therefore he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. And this is how desperate Rachel is to bear a child and to keep up with Leah. She sells her husband's affections for the night for what she thinks is a fertility drug. So when Jacob came out to the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. Oh boy. And he lay that night with her. And God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Leah said, God has given me my wages because I have given my maid to my husband. And so she called his name Issachar, which means hire. Leah feels vindicated for what she's done, but imagine how Rachel now feels. She trades a night with Jacob for the mandrakes. She gets the fertility meds, but Leah gets pregnant. That is not how it's supposed to work. Then Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons. And so she called his name Zebulun, which means dwelling. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. And you got to have pity on this little girl. This little girl now gets added to this messy, disordered family. Of course, the reason for this chapter, with its drama and dysfunction, is to introduce us to the founding fathers of the nation Israel's 12 tribes, which should encourage us. For just because a family starts out twisted doesn't mean God can't straighten it out and end up using it in great ways in the future, just as he did Jacob's. You remember Rachel's problem was that she forgot that our timing is not always God's timing. Verse 22. Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb, and she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph, which means Yahweh has added. And she said, the Lord shall add to me another son, and that he did. Many years later, Rachel births Benjamin, her second son, but at a steep price. In Genesis 35, we'll read it next week, Jacob and Rachel, they enter the promised land, and near Bethel, she goes into labor, and Rachel dies while delivering her second son, Benjamin. That's for next week. Verse 25. And it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know my service which I have done for you. It's time for Jacob and his family to head back to the promised land, back to Canaan from where he had come. And Laban said to him, please stay if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. Then he said, name me your wages and I will give it. In other words, Laban asked his son-in-law, now tell me, what is it going to take to keep you around a little while longer? You've been a blessing to me. So Jacob said to him, you know how I have served you and how your livestock have been with me. For what you had before I came was little, and it is now increased to a great amount. The Lord has blessed you since my coming. And now when shall I also provide for my own house? So he said, what shall I give you? And Jacob said, you shall not give me anything. In other words, I only want what I've earned. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from there all the speckled and spotted sheep, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and these shall be my wages. And he wants a cut of the herd. In the Middle East to this very day, most sheep are white, and most goats are brown or black. Solid pigmentation was a dominant trait. Speckled and spotted was less common and indicated a recessive gene. And so, if Laban gets the solid color herd, he will fare better. But Jacob says, so my righteousness will answer for me in time to come. I'm trusting God to even this out. When the subject of my wages comes before you, everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the lambs will be considered stolen if it is with me. And Laban said, oh, that it were according to your word. See, Laban realized, he's a true businessman, remember. He realizes that Jacob's deal is going to greatly benefit him. Jacob seems to be deliberately defying natural laws and relying on God to multiply his herds. That's to Jacob's credit. And so he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, everyone that had some white in it, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and gave them into the hand of his sons. And then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. The flocks were separated to see how they would reproduce over time. But in verse 37, Jacob employs an unusual practice. Now Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar and of the almond and the chestnut trees, peeled white strips in them, and exposed the white which was in the rods. In the rods which he had peeled, he set before the flocks in the gutters, in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they came to drink. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. Now, it's not actually clear exactly what happens here. Jacob may have been engaging in some form of selective breeding. It could be that the rods released a chemical into the water and affected the pigmentation. As to Jacob's motive, though, this might have been a shepherd's way of hedging his bet. Just in case God doesn't bless my flocks, here's what I'm going to do. Well, then Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the streaked and all the brown in the flock of Laban. But he put his own flocks by themselves and did not put them with Laban's flock. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger livestock conceived, that Jacob placed the rods before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in. So the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. And thus the man became exceedingly prosperous. In the Hebrew it renders it, and the man burst out exceedingly, exceedingly. And he had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Again, the science here is uncertain. But the result is that God multiplied Jacob's flock. You know, to me, the most likely interpretation is that God isn't blessing Jacob's cleverness at all. He's actually blessing his faith. In chapter 31, verse 10, we're going to read that Jacob had a dream where God multiplies his flock as an act of faithfulness to him. And see, this was the lesson that God was teaching Jacob all along, that he needed to trust in God, not in his own schemes. Well, chapter 31 begins with Jacob hearing the complaint of Laban's sons and seeing the countenance of Laban. Both indicate to him that he's gotten the better end of this deal. God's leading him home becomes more pressing. In verse 31, chapter 31, verse 4, Jacob calls a family meeting. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock, and said to them, I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me. And you know that with all might I have served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore speckle. And he said thus, the streaked shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. Jacob admits that it's not his breeding techniques that have multiplied the flocks. It's been God's blessing. Which should be a lesson to pastors, by the way. You know, it seems every new megachurch we get, some pastor has to have a new church growth conference. He wants to articulate his techniques and his methods, et cetera, as if the large flock was grown by his cleverness, not God's spirit. Here Jacob is clear. His mega flocks aren't the result of his brilliance, but of God's blessing. Verse 10. And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream. And behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray spotted. Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob. And I said, here I am. And he said, lift your eyes now and see, all the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. In other words, God's looking out for Jacob. This is like getting a heavenly stock market tip, is what this is. He's saying, invest in the speckled and spotted. They're being sired by God. And notice this isn't just an angel. The term means messenger. The term angel means messenger. It can be divine or human. This angel says, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. You remember, it was at Bethel that Jacob had the vision of the ladder extending to heaven. And remember, Jesus is Jacob's ladder. This angel is now testifying. He's now identifying himself as the God of Bethel. I believe this is Jesus appearing to Jacob. The angel had met Jacob before he left from Haran, and now he tells Jacob it's time to return home. He says, now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family. Verse 14. Well, then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Now, amazingly, these squabbling sisters, they finally come together, but it's over their shared greed. They want the dad's inheritance before they leave. And are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and has also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. The girls realize that Laban hasn't loved them. He's just treated them like livestock. And here they renounce their loyalty to their dad and they pledge to follow Jacob. And then Jacob arose and he set his sons and his wives on camels. And he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock which he had gained in Padan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Jacob loads up a family caravan and he tries to sneak away from Laban. But now Laban had gone to shear his sheep and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. Now understand, this doesn't mean that Rachel worshiped idols. You remember her mother, Rebekah, had sent Jacob to Haran, or Jacob's mother, Rebekah, had sent him to Haran in the first place so that he could find a wife who was not an idolater. I think what Rachel cares about here is not the idols per se, but her and her sister's inheritance. And she's thinking that by possessing Laban's idols, in some way, it'll strengthen her claim to the inheritance. Verse 20. And Jacob stole away unknown to Laban the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. And so he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the river, the Euphrates that is, and he headed toward the mountains of Gilead, just east of the Jordan River. And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. In other words, Jacob had a 3-day head start. Then Laban took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days' journey. And he overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. Laban chased Jacob's caravan 300 miles from Syria to Gilead. But God had come to Laban, the Syrian, in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad." In other words, God was protecting Jacob, even in his foolish state, even in this unbelieving state. God still had his hand on Jacob's life. So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword?" That wasn't true. They voluntarily came with Jacob. "Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? For I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with timbrel and harp." Sure. Not hardly. He didn't want them to leave. Verse 28. "And you did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters." Oh, this is the crying father-in-law, you know. "Now you have done foolishly in so doing. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.' And now you have surely gone because you greatly long for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" And here is a funny thought. What good is a god that can be stolen? Not much. Thus, the folly of idols. Last week, I heard one of our presidential candidates make the comment, "You don't have to abandon your faith to vote for abortion rights." Well, if your faith is in a God that can be stolen and hidden, then maybe so. You can use a false God for selfish and for self-serving purposes. You can put words in the mouth of an idol. You can make your idol say whatever you want it to say. But if your faith is in the Christian God, His word requires that we respect life in the womb. You don't hold a biblical faith in a living God without upholding the sanctity of life. A real God can never be hijacked. And then Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid, and I said, 'Perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force, with whomever you find your gods, do not let them live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you.'" Jacob worshiped the true God, and he had no use for Laban's idols nor for their worshipers. But he didn't know, verse 32, for Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And Laban went into Jacob's tent, into Leah's tent, and into the two maids' tents. In other words, he searched around frantically, and he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. And now Rachel had taken the household idols, put them in the camel's saddle, and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me." Oh, this Rachel. My, oh, my. This Rachel has been with Jacob for too long. She has turned into a schemer herself. You know what she's saying here? She's saying, "I can't get off this camel." And she blames it on her time of the month. What father is going to question that? And he searched, but he did not find the household idols. And this all angers Jacob. He's been falsely accused now, he thinks. "If any contraband was found, show us the evidence now," he says. And emboldened, Jacob now stands up to his father-in-law. And in the next few verses, I'm just going to summarize them. Jacob recounts the faithful shepherd that he's been for 20 years, that he's been out there delivering baby sheep, and he's endured predators and thieves, and he's cared for Laban's flocks despite the drought and the frost and the sleepless nights. He served 14 years for his wives and 6 years for Jacob's flocks, and yet Laban had lied to him. In fact, he'd changed his wages 10 times, he says. And then Jacob says in verse 42, unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. In other words, if God hadn't defended me, I would have left you bankrupt. And notice this unusual name for God that gets mentioned here in verse 42. Jacob calls God the fear of Isaac. Isn't that interesting? You recall when Isaac blessed the younger over the older, it hit him in that moment that God had kept the promise, but not because of him, in spite of him. You remember that? This created in Isaac a deep fear or respect for God's sovereignty, that ultimately God's will gets done with us or without us. Verse 43, and Laban answered and said to Jacob, these daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and this flock is my flock. He's standing up to his father-in-law now. All that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? And here's a classic case of an overbearing in-law. I mean, Laban ignores Jacob's role in siring his sons. He lays claim to his family. He said, this is my family. No, it's not. It's my family. This is why God said to married couples in the beginning, leave your father and your mother and cleave to your wife. If you've got meddling in-laws, you are wise in seeking a separation sooner rather than later. Laban concedes, now therefore come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Then Jacob said to his brethren, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap. And they ate there on the heap. And Laban called it Jigar Sarahutha. But Jacob called it Galeed. Both names mean heap of witness. Laban's is Aramaic. Jacob's name is Hebrew. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore its name was called Galeed, also Mizpah. A lot of names getting thrown around. Because he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. Mizpah means watch. And Laban here is a skeptical father-in-law. He's basically saying to his son-in-law, may God watch you like a hawk. Keeping my eye on you, boy. Verse 50. If you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives beside my daughters, although no man is with us, see God is witness between you and me. You mistreat my girls, God's going to get you. Can't blame Laban for that. Been there myself. And then Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap and here is this pillar, which I have placed between you and me. This heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness, that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. Now this pile of rocks will be their border. And it's a wise move to set boundaries with domineering in-laws. If you're one of those in-laws, I hate saying this, but you need to back off. You need to let your kids live their lives. They're the ones that have made this. They have formed new family units. It's not your family anymore. It's their family. And they need to have the freedom to build their own lives. Now Laban continues, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain, and he called his brethren to eat bread, and they ate bread and stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. He finally gets to kiss them goodbye. And then Laban departed and returned to his place. Now realize, Jacob's 20 years in Haran have humbled him. Remember, he left Canaan a double-crosser. He double-crossed Esau. And now he's returning, having been double-crossed himself by Laban. It started with Rachel and Leah, and yet Laban had changed his wages 10 times, he said. God, in turn, had been faithful to Jacob. He had prospered his herds and he delivered him from Laban. The schemer has been learning that he can trust the Lord. And all this leads up to the profound encounter that occurs now in chapter 32. So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim, which means double camp. Jacob had pitched his tent, and he had made physical camp. But here he learns that there is also a spiritual camp side by side his camp in the very same space that is occupied by angels assigned to his protection. And did you know if you're a child of God, angel armies camp with you as well? Hebrews chapter 1 verse 14 refers to angels as ministering spirits to the heirs of salvation. Does this mean there are guardian angels? Absolutely it does. Mine even works overtime. I keep him running. Verse 3. Now then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." Now, Jacob had left one adversary, Laban, but now he faces a confrontation with Esau. The last time, you remember, he had heard from Esau, his brother had vowed to kill him. But then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." And Jacob gets no indication as to Esau's thinking or his motive, just that he's coming to meet him with 400 men. And an army of 400 marching troops doesn't sound like the welcome wagon. Sounds like trouble. Jacob doesn't know what to expect from Esau. All he knows is that Esau has had 20 years now for his anger to boil. Jacob is scared, no doubt about it. And so he begins to divide his entourage in half. If one company is attacked, then that means the other company will be able to escape. And in verse 9, Jacob prays a prayer of protection. And I want you to notice three things about this prayer. I wish I could delve into it further, but just three things. Jacob's newfound humility, comes back a humble man. His honesty, straightforward with his feelings. And then when he prays God's promises, which is always a good way to pray. It's to remind God of his promises. And so Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you.'" Notice this, "I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant." It's a newfound humility. "For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau." And he's honest, "For I fear him. I am scared to death, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, 'I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.' Save me, Lord, you've promised." Good prayer to pray. And so he lodged there that same night and took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother. 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their colts. Didn't know there was such a thing as a milk camel, but I guess there is. 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 foals. This is a sizable peace offering he's about to make to Esau. And he sends it on ahead of him. Then he delivered them to the hands of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass over before me and put some distance between successive droves." In other words, let's spread this out. It'll look more impressive if it comes to him in waves. And he commanded the first one, saying, When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going? Whose are these in front of you? Then you shall say, they are your servant Jacob's. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us. And then he instructs the second wave and the third wave of the servants to do the same. Jacob is going to send waves of welcome, hoping to gradually soften his brother Esau's heart toward him. He's going to sleep in the camp that night, but the next day he knows he's going to meet his brother. The only problem, again, he's trusting in his own manipulations rather than in God. And this is Jacob's perpetual sin. Yet, God is about to cure him of it once and for all. Verse 22. And he arose that night and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. The name means emptying. On the one hand, the Jabbok was just a stream that emptied into the Jordan River, but the name is prophetic, for it's at the Jabbok that Jacob finally empties himself of his self-confidence and his self-reliance. For there he took his family and sent them over the brook and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. Now Jacob is alone, all by himself. And he's at the end of his rope. He knows he's vulnerable. All of his past sins are now coming back to haunt him. Doesn't know what the next day's going to hold. He's worried that at any time Esau might jump out of the bushes and attack him. And this time, Mama won't be there to save him. No. Jacob is now solely dependent on God. He faces the dark of the night and the uncertainty of tomorrow with only faith at his disposal. You see, it's at this brook called emptying that Jacob empties out himself and finally sees the face of God. For then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. And I'm sure I know what happened. At first, Jacob thought it was Esau. His brother's trying to kill him with his bare hands. And remember, Esau was a tough guy. He was an outdoorsman. He was a hunter. He was a killer. Imagine Jacob flailing and kicking and fighting for his very life. Verse 25. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. See, Jacob was fighting with this man so tenaciously that the man he's wrestling with has to loosen Jacob's grip. He touches his hip socket, and it throws his hip out of joint. It must have been painful, like an athlete going down with a blown knee. Imagine Jacob grabbing for his hip. And the man wrestling with Jacob said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." Apparently, they've been wrestling all night long. But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." See, as dawn approaches, it finally dawns on Jacob that he's not fighting Esau. He's been wrestling with the divine. The man asks him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." And Israel means Prince of God. Now let me ask you, have you been wrestling lately? Who have you been wrestling with? You thought you were fighting your spouse, or maybe your kids, or an ex-spouse. Or maybe you've been wrestling with your boss, you think, or your neighbor. But think about it. Could it be that you've really been wrestling with God? All your life, you've found ways to get your way. All your life, you've been scheming to get your own way. But now you're being forced to surrender to God's will, to someone else's will, not your own. Don't you think it's time to give up and give in? That's what Jacob realizes here. when it dawns on him that he's really been wrestling God, he stops fighting and he starts praying. He tightens his grip on God. He refuses to let him go until he receives his blessing. Jacob finally admits his need for God. He becomes desperate for God's blessing. Instead of fighting God, he now embraces God. He goes from a headlock to a hug. And here's what's intriguing. Jacob now puts as much effort into his faith as he did in his fight. And this is how God wants us to approach him once we surrender to him and give him our lives. He wants us to take the vigor that we put into fighting him and fighting his will. Now we should put that vigor into following him. We need to cry out for God's highest and holiest blessing. Don't let go until you get all that God has for you. And then verse 29, then Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why is it that you have asked about my name?" And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, or face of God. "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." And I believe it was none other than our Lord Jesus with whom Jacob wrestled that night. And I have known many a person, myself included, who spent too long wrestling with his lordship before I completely surrendered to his will. But once I did, I have sought God's best for me every single day since. Notice too, verse 31. Just as he crossed over Peniel, the sun rose on him and he limped on his hip. Hey, Jacob had wrestled with God, but it cost him. And when you wrestle with God, it will cost you. It'll cost you your pride. It'll cost you some of your self-sufficiency. For the rest of his life, Jacob limped, for it was a permanent sign of his weakness before God. It was a reminder to walk by faith, not by your own cleverness. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank. And apparently this was a tradition practiced by observant Jews up until the time of the writing of this here in Genesis. Well, chapter 33 tells us what occurred the next day. Now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming, and with him those 400 men. And so he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last, apparently in order of his affections. And then he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Jacob is now a humble man. He's not ashamed. He bows 7 times. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him. And they wept. What a reunion. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, "Who are these with you?" And he said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." And God is now restoring a broken family. Isn't it beautiful? Verse 6. And then the maidservants came near, they and their children, and bowed down. And Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. And then Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company which I met?" He's talking about the ways of gifts that had been sent to him. And Jacob said, "These are to find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." And Jacob said, "No, please. If I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand. Inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me." Jacob realizes the former hostility with Esau was his fault. See, Jacob's biggest enemy wasn't his brother, it was his himself. That could be your biggest enemy. It's amazing. When a man makes peace with God, peace with his brother will ultimately follow. Jacob is so grateful for what God has done. In verse 11, he begs Esau to take his gift. He takes it, and he wants to travel with Jacob. Though their reunion was sweet, Jacob knows spiritually he and his brother are headed in different directions. There's no need for them to travel together. They've made peace. Now they can move on. And so in verse 15, Esau said, "Now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." Wait a minute now. We don't want to start this again. Unwanted people in the family. But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." And so Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, and Jacob journeyed to Succoth, built himself a house, and made booths, that is, shelters, for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth, or booths. And then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city. Now Jacob made a wise decision to separate himself from Laban, and then again from Esau. But as we'll see, he makes a poor decision here by settling near this pagan city of Shechem. We'll find that out next week. And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohi Israel, which means God, the God of Israel. And for the very first time, look at it, Jacob builds an altar. Abraham had built altars everywhere, but for the very first time now, after wrestling with God, Jacob has surrendered and he builds an altar. And he becomes a worshiper. Are you a worshiper?